everyone. Welcome back to the Manic Manor podcast. This is Mitchie. So I want to start off with today's episode by putting in a preface that this is going to be a very heavy one. It's going to be filled with a lot of triggers, including sexual assault and graphic nature. So I do advise that you listen to this with the pure utmost discretion. So this is a case that happened in my home state of Tennessee in Knoxville. This happened back in 2007, and anybody who is familiar with this area, anybody who has lived in this area, especially if you've been here your entire life, knows of this case. It is the case of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom, and I honest to God believe that it is probably one of the worst crimes to come out of my home state. And when I get to talk about it, you'll understand why. So we're going to start off talking about Chris and Shannon. So Chris was born Hugh Christopher Newsom, September 21st, 1983, and he was a Knoxville native. Chris's mother, Mary, spoke of him extremely high, said that he didn't know a stranger, and anybody who did know him was essentially one of his best friends. He played baseball throughout his entire childhood, into his teenage years, and especially when he got into high school at Halls. After he graduated high school, he went on to go to Pellissippi State Community College and began work as a carpenter. And he was 23 years old at the time of the crime that we're going to talk about. Shannon was born Shannon Gail Christian, April 29th, 1985 in Texas. She then moved to Louisiana with her family, and they then relocated from Louisiana to Tennessee in 1997. Now, her teenage years, she attended Farragut High School, and Shannon's mother, Dina, and her father, Gary, said that while nobody was a perfect human being, ideally, she was as close to perfect as you could get. She never gave any trouble, she did extremely well in school, and was a very humble person. She was attending the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and would have graduated December of 2007 with a major in sociology, and she worked very, very hard. In fact, she was working two jobs to get through school. And at the time of the crime, she was 21 years old. Both Chris and Shannon lived with their parents at home, and they had a very close relationship. Although Chris, it was said that he came and went as he pleased because his parents just had that much trust in him as a person. Chris and Shannon both started dating in November of 2006. And although it was a very short-lived relationship, everybody said that they had an absolutely beautiful one. So we're going to go and we're going to talk about the incident, the crime. January 6, 2007, both Chris and Shannon were going to be attending a birthday party for one of their mutual friends, and they would be going out to dinner as well. They ended up staying at Shannon's best friend's house, and they were watching a movie beforehand. According to her parents, Shannon called about 12:35 to say that she would be coming home instead of just continuing to hang out with her friends, but she would never make it home. Chris's parents, like I said before, said it wasn't unusual for him to not be home at certain times. They trusted him. He was a grown person. He came and went as he needed because he did have a job and he did have his own life. They didn't have any restrictions on him. But they would have no clue that he was missing until Shannon's mother would call them to inform them that Shannon never came home to prepare for work, and that was completely out of the ordinary for Shannon. There was increasing worry when Shannon's best friend had called and said that they didn't end up appearing at the party, Chris and Shannon. With both Shannon and Chris being legal adults, here's what is so fucked up. The local authorities essentially told them that they wouldn't be able to step in for at least 24 hours after the initial 911 call was made by Dina. And it was an absolutely horrifying wait for the family and friends of Shannon and Chris. They pinged Shannon's cell phone, and it showed that her cell phone had last gotten a signal near Cherry Street in Knoxville. Back then, it was known to be a neighborhood with a high crime rate. Cherry Street and the area of Magnolia, essentially. Even today, there's parts that I have heard with Magnolia saying that you just kind of want to avoid that area for all safety purposes. Now, the crime that we're talking about spans from the late night of January 6th to the early hours of January 7, 2007. Now, it was stated that Chris and Shannon were standing beside her car, they were embracing and hugging, and they were at this time at what is formerly known as the Washington Ridge Apartments. I don't know which name they've taken now, but they did end up changing their names, or it could be just a completely new complex, for all I know, with the sheer amount of time that has passed. It was during this time that they were embracing with each other that they were carjacked and abducted from the parking lot. The abductors took them to a house that was at 2316 Shipman Street. I'm going to preface this right now and say that that house is no longer standing. Now, the abductors were LaMarcus Davidson, George Thomas, Latelvis Cobbins, and Eric Boyd. LaMarcus was considered to be the ringleader of this group and had a string of prior convictions relating to carjacking and robbery. Initially, it was claimed to have been just a simple carjacking, but this thing turned into an absolute house of horror. The couple, they claimed they picked them up at random, and they said it was pretty much a wrong place, wrong time scenario. Now, as they were kidnapped, they were bound with ropes. And when they arrived at the house, there was a woman named Vanessa Coleman who was waiting. So now we have five people that are actively involved in this kidnapping and carjacking. So at this time at the house, the kidnappers began to get high on drugs like PCP, and they would keep Shannon and Chris hostage in separate rooms. Shannon was put with Vanessa, and the men took Chris. This is where things are going to get extremely dark, so I'm putting the trigger warning right here for you all. Please skip it or just stop listening to this episode if this is something that you cannot handle. The events that unfolded on both Chris and Shannon are absolutely beyond horrifying. Now, looking back on it, the authorities believe that Chris was the first to be subjected to an extreme bout of torture, with at least one of these men assaulting him inside of the house themselves, as well as with random objects. It ensued for hours before they tied him up, forced him outside in just a t-shirt and boxers to walk barefoot along a set of train tracks, and they had also gagged him. Now, this is in the middle of winter. Winters in Tennessee can get very cold very quickly. So he was pretty much left to the elements as they were taking him to what would be his final place. It's believed also that they used a ragged dog leash on him just to keep him from running away to try to get help. So after walking on the tracks, Chris was forced to kneel on the railroad where they bound his feet together with a belt and they laid him on the tracks. Now while he was laid on the tracks, he was shot in the back of the neck, but this isn't the thing that killed him. They shot at him again, and his brainstem was severed, and because of this second shot, this is what killed him. They essentially put him out execution style. So as his body was laying there, the group would wrap up his body and place it onto a mattress, where they then doused his body in gasoline and lit it on fire and left his corpse there to burn. They would make their way back to the house where Shannon was still at, being held captive in a bedroom with Coleman supervising to make sure that she didn't run out. She would endure a very prolonged torture, and like I said, we spoke in the start how she had told her parents that she would be late, and a lot of people are seeming to speculate that she was forced to make this call to her parents, and they were none the wiser that Chris had already been killed and that she was held captive. She was then beaten, choked, and raped orally, anally, and vaginally multiple times. The injuries from this assault were so bad that she suffered very, very severe injuries. They also, just like Chris, put foreign objects into her, and it would cause a massive hemorrhage, as they would later discover. Her head also had hemorrhaging because they stepped on her head with their boots, and she suffered severe carpet burns from being dragged around during this time. Now, essentially, they grew bored of her and came to the conclusion that because of everything that they did while still being high on these drugs, that they had to get rid of any kind of DNA that was on her. So what did they do? They led her into a bathroom. They poured bleach down her throat and all over her body and began scrubbing super hard to try to rid any DNA evidence off of her. They covered her face with a trash bag and tied her in a fetal position before placing her body in a series of multiple trash bags, all while she was still alive. They then took her body and dumped it into a garbage can. They threw sheets and a lot of bedding on top to keep her in there and kind of muffle her screams. And she stayed like this for days while she slowly suffocated due to the condition that she was in. It said that her time of death was between the 7th and 8th of January in the afternoon, and when she was found, her eyes were still wide open in fear. Now, another thing that is very disgusting is that Davidson took Shannon's clothes and personal belongings from her and gave it to his girlfriend. He also had taken Chris's phone and his shoes and was wearing his shoes after the fact. So without the police help for the first 24 hours, it was essentially up to both sets of parents and the friends of Shannon and Chris to try to retrace their last steps to just try to figure out where they were. After they had been kidnapped, friends went back to the apartment where they were last at to see if her car was still there or if they could find any trace of them, but they couldn't find Shannon, Chris, or Shannon's car. Now, next to the house on Chipman Street was a Waste Connection service. A worker later testified that around 12:30 in the morning of January 7th, they saw lights on in the house and noted how odd it was for the house to look and seem that busy with all the lights on at that time at night. Now, Shannon's car was a Toyota 4Runner, and the worker also testified to seeing a Toyota 4Runner slowly driving by, and he noted that in this car there were four men, and he described them as being black men that stared at him as they were driving by. Another witness claimed to have heard three popping sounds coming from the nearby train tracks around 1:45 in the morning. Now, with Shannon's phone pinging at Cherry Street, the family did in fact go and searched for her and Chris in that area, and when they did that, they found Shannon's car abandoned on Monday the 8th. And when they looked in the car, there were many things that were missing, including a teddy bear that Shannon had, as well as her iPod and a phone charger. They also noted that the seats of the car were pushed so far back that Shannon wouldn't have been able to reach the pedals, and mud was covering the floor of the car, and the stickers that were on her car were now gone and missing. Now, they found a pack of Newport cigarettes in the car, but neither Shannon nor Chris were smokers. They found also an envelope in the car that would eventually give a fingerprint, leading to LaMarcus Davidson. And their house on Chipman Street, LaMarcus's house, was two blocks away from where the car was found. Now, it would be a little past noon on January 7th when Chris's body would be discovered by a railroad employee. When the authorities took the body, they found that there was still trace evidence of semen, but because of the fire, it removed any kind of DNA evidence that could link them to who did it to him. But like I said, they were able to get DNA evidence off of the envelope via a fingerprint. And this fingerprint was what led the police to get a match to Davidson, and they were able to warrant a search for the house. When they went to the house, they found it to be completely abandoned and empty, minus a garbage can that was left in the kitchen. Now, of course, with the garbage can being like the epicenter of this house, they would look into it thinking that maybe there was somebody that was hiding in there. It wasn't somebody hiding. It was Shannon. They found a lifeless arm as the first thing to be sticking out. When they pulled her out and recovered her, they noticed that semen was still in her mouth, as well as her vagina and her anus. Unlike Chris, where the DNA evidence had been burned away, the DNA evidence was still on Shannon, and they found it was a match to LaMarcus and Latavius Cobbins. They also found Davidson's prints on the trash bag, as well as the box that was nearby that the trash bags had come in. Not only that, but they uncovered belongings of Chris and Shannon both still in the house, also shoved into trash bags. They also found shell casings that matched the bullet that was used to kill Chris, because they were able to recover that from Chris's body. So it was hook, line, and sinker that the people in this house were behind it. So they began a manhunt for everyone involved. They would find Davidson hiding in a vacant home after they had caught Boyd, and Boyd had directed them to where he was during the arrest. Now, when Davidson was caught, he was passing the blame onto Cobbins and Thomas. Now, it was around this time that they had caught Cobbins and Thomas, as well as Coleman, finding them in Lebanon, Kentucky. While they were searching, they found a computer in this area in Kentucky where Thomas and Cobbins had been viewing the news coverage of the murders. Davidson would slowly change his story, and he would, in fact, change it roughly about 5 times. First, he had claimed that he knew nothing about these crimes. He then went on to say that Cobbins and Thomas came to the house about 10 o'clock in the evening on Friday or Saturday. And he said that they had told him that they had carjacked people, and these people they carjacked were still in the car. Davidson claimed he saw them, but wanted nothing to do with the crime and left to smoke pot. When he came back, he said Shannon had told him that she didn't want to die, and he just left her there, using the car to go deal drugs before he cleaned it out. He would also claim that he didn't rape anyone and didn't go into the bedrooms at all. Which is kind of fucking ironic considering his DNA was found at least on Shannon's body. So talking about Cobbins and the story that he made, he had said that he, Davidson, and Boyd went to this apartment complex and abducted the couple because they were there just to meet a girl, and they saw them and decided that they were just going to carjack them and take them to the house where they kept Shannon and Chris. Now, he stated that he kept Shannon and Boyd took Chris. Boyd came back without Chris, is what he would say, and he also denied raping anybody. Coleman admitted to being in the house and said that she too was a hostage. However, I highly fucking doubt this, because later during the investigation, there was a journal that was found, and there was an entry on January 9th saying, quote, "I had one hell of an adventure. It's going to be a long, interesting year," end quote. When they compared handwriting, they found that it was Coleman's journal because her handwriting matched with the handwriting in this book. And so this proceeded into what would be many trials coming from this murder. The first trial had the 4 men indicted in Knox County, and the trials were supposed to be separated between May to August of 2008, which eventually some of them got moved to 2009. The judge that was going to be hearing this case was Richard Baumgartner. He's got a pretty fucked up story as well. Now, he allowed Thomas and Cobbins to be tried by Davidson County juries, and he scheduled trial for August 11, 2008, and he had said that also the phone calls that were being made between the perpetrators were going to be admissible evidence. So the district attorney at the time, Randy Nichols, said that the state would be seeking the death penalty for Cobbins and Coleman's if they were to be convicted. So, looking at Davidson, he was being indicted for the murder, but he also got another indictment because just the day after committing these murders, he went and he robbed a local Pizza Hut. Now, the defense team for him said that they were going to need a change of venue in order to have a fair trial. The state argued back that a fair, impartial jury could be brought in during the jury voir dire process. And for anybody who doesn't know what that is, that's essentially just the process of interviewing potential jurors to see if they're going to be fair and impartial. Now, that motion was denied by Baumgartner and said that it was premature, and threatened also during this time that he would ban the Newsom family from court after the defense got insulted. I mean, Davidson's defense got insulted. the defense attorney for Davidson, I'm just going to put his name out there, Attorney Doug Trant. And I'm pretty sure he is still practicing today in Tennessee. And all they did was essentially say that Doug Trant as an attorney was a jerk. Now, going through all the trials here, Boyd was the first to get a verdict. He was found guilty of being an accessory to the fatal carjacking and failing to report the location of his friends. He was the only one not to get charged with any form of murder and was given a sentence of 18 years max in a federal prison. I think currently he is at Yazoo County Federal Correction Institution. Cobbins was the next, April 25th of 2009. He was found guilty of murder in the first degree for Shannon, guilty of facilitating the murder of Chris, and somehow was acquitted of Chris's rape. Instead of getting a death penalty, he ended up getting life without parole. October 8th, 2009, Davidson was finally given a verdict of guilty. Jurors unanimously agreed for the death on four capital charges, two first-degree murder charges, and two premeditated first-degree murder charges. In June 2010, he was sentenced to 80 years for other murder-related charges and also received a death penalty, both to be served consecutively. Now, during Davidson's sentencing, Bumgarter said that the crimes were so incredibly outrageous, cruel, and inhumane. One the court had never seen before, and it was unexplainable how anybody could do this and that there would be no sentence that would be great enough to punish for the lives that were lost. His death sentence was affirmed by the Supreme Court in Tennessee in 2016. December 8th, 2009, Thomas was found guilty with a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, Vanessa Coleman was the last to get a trial, and she was given a trial with a granted immunity from federal authorities for, in exchange for her testimony. However, the state courts ruled that her immunity would not protect her from any kind of murder or rape charges, only the carjacking. She was acquitted of first-degree murder, but found guilty on a lesser charge in May of 2010, and was sentenced in July to 53 years in prison. At this sentencing, at Coleman's sentencing, Shannon's father came up and made a victim impact statement and stated how his baby was taken from him, and that not only did she take his baby from him, but she had taken his blessing to a young man away, a wedding dance away, and any future grandchildren that he may have had. The defendants, of course, did try to appeal these convictions. Now, remember how I said that Bumgarter was pretty fucked up? Well, in March of 2011, he was forced to resign as a judge. He admitted to having a drug addiction and would buy them from convicts. He ended up going to federal prison for lying to investigators. And when the news came out that he was more than likely high while holding court, this was a key to grant a retrial of any cases that he was potentially high in. Now, he ended up passing away in his home in January 2018. So, of course, because of him being high, this granted retrials for the defendants. But in May of 2012, the Tennessee Supreme Court overturned a ruling ordering trials or retrials for Cobbins, Davidson, and Thomas, and the citation was that a judge's misconduct out of the court did not necessarily require a new trial unless they could prove that the misconduct affected those proceedings. Now, there was a judge, Judge Blackwood, who did grant new trials on the quote-unquote 13th juror rule. For anybody who doesn't know what that is, that's essentially where the judge signs off after all 12 jurors give their, you know, their answer on what they believe, guilty or not guilty. Now, the prosecution, they wanted Blackwood to be recused from the case due to an emotional investment in his communication with the defense. And he did get recused. So when he was recused, Senior Judge Walter Kurtz was now the one overseeing the retrials and seeing if they would be needed. They only granted a retrial for Thomas and Coleman. Cobbins and Davidson kept their sentences. Now, Coleman got her retrial, and She was convicted of the facilitation of aggravated kidnapping, rape, and murder of Shannon, but not Chris. Now, the prosecution wanted the max amount of nearly 50 years, while defense said that she should only get 20. She was given 35 years in prison, with time served being credited to it for the time that she was already in prison. So she ended up essentially getting 25 years after the fact. And she tried to file again for another retrial, but in 2014, she was denied. 2013, Thomas was retried, and once again, he got a guilty verdict and was resentenced to life in prison, but he could be paroled after 51 years. He also got two consecutive life sentences plus 25 years for both the murder and rape, tried to appeal in 2015 and 2016, but was subsequently denied. Boyd had another indictment on March 20th, 2018, and I remember watching this trial as it went down. The Knox County Grand Jury returned an indictment charging Boyd with first-degree felony murder, premeditated first-degree murder, aggravated robbery, kidnapping, and rape. That trial was held in 2019. During this trial, Thomas was allowed to have his sentence reduced to a second degree in exchange for testifying against Boyd, as well as having that sentence lessened from rape to assault, and getting the ability to have parole within 50 years. August 13th, 2019, they found Boyd guilty on nearly every charge, and he had an immediate sentence to life in prison. Now, he did try to request a new trial, but in 2019, 2021, and 2022 was completely denied each time. Today, Coleman is being held at the Deborah K. Johnson Rehabilitation Center in Nashville. She was eligible for parole in 2017. Families of Shannon and Chris, when they were notified that she had the possibility to be paroled because of good behavior, they also heard that the sentence was going to be reduced 16 days per month, making her available for parole or eligible for parole as early as October of 2014. Now, they did a hearing in December of 2014, but she was denied parole. December 2020, there was another parole hearing for her, but she was denied, and this was because Shannon and Chris's mother, as well as Chris's father, gave impact statements in opposition to her being freed. It was unanimous that she was going to need to be kept behind bars, and currently she is not set to have another parole hearing for at least another 10 years. Cobbins and Thomas, they were once at the Riverbend Maximum Security Prison. They were then transferred to Bledsoe County Correctional Complex. From there, Cobbins was moved to the Northwest Correctional Complex, and Thomas was moved to the Northeast Correctional Complex. Davidson is at Riverbend, and he is on death row, still awaiting death. Boyd is at Bledsoe County Correctional Complex. Now, talking about the media outlet and the outrage of the people, there was a ton of issue with the press from people. There were critics that claimed that the murder never actually made national news because the victims were white and the assailants were black. Most news coverages that you will see of this case are from local newses, and it's either it was reported on while it was happening or they're online. However, the chief of police at the time claimed that there was no racial motivation for the crime and that it was simply cold-blooded murder because the perpetrators quote-unquote, dated and were friends with white people. But this did not stop a lot of people from saying that this crime was so horrendous that it had to be racially motivated. And I saw somewhere that even Chris's mother disagreed with the chief of police's statement that it wasn't. Shannon's father addressed his belief that his daughter's death was being used to feed an agenda. And the way that some people bring about it, I can see why he would honestly believe that. There was a parade that happened in 2007. It was like May 27th, if I remember. And it wasn't necessarily a parade. It was more like a protest. And it had like 30 white supremacists going in downtown Knoxville, protesting what had happened to Shannon and Chris. And this is where I can see why Shannon's father believed that people were just using this to fuel an agenda. Now, the media also got a shit ton of backlash because there was early reportings citing, like, the bodies were heavily mutilated and dismembered, and the DA later would come out and deny this. So it was a heavy divide on whether or not it was a black versus white crime, or simply just, was this good versus bad, right and wrong? Now we're going to look at the aftermath of the murders. Like I said, the house that was on 2316 Shipman Street, it was demolished. It was bought by the Waste Connection place that I mentioned earlier, and they replaced the house with a memorial for Shannon and Chris. Out of this also came the Shannon Gale Christian Foundation and the Shannon Gale Christian Memorial Golf Tournament that were made in her memory and honor to give a scholarship to a Farragut High School senior so they would be able to attend the University of Tennessee. Chris also had a foundation that was found in his name, and it holds an annual baseball tournament at the Halls Community Park. And it would be like a scholarship that was also given for any graduating baseball player, and the scholarship was under Chris's name. With this murder, there were also two acts that were introduced in 2014 in Tennessee. The first one was the Chris Newsom Act. It was introduced to eliminate the need for a judge's signature for a jury verdict after the delivery of a unanimous verdict. So that essentially removed the 13th juror rule that we saw earlier, where the judge had to sign off to validate the ruling. And had this been enacted before, it would have prevented the retrials from ever even having an opportunity to take place. The second one was the Shannon Christian Act. This act restricted either the attorney or the defendant, and when I say the attorney, I'm talking about the defense attorney, from trying to defame a victim's character. They couldn't make allegations on behavior or anything like that that would paint this person as looking bad. And this is because during Davidson's trial, the trial got so nasty that he was trying to claim that Shannon was there as a drug addict who came to buy drugs at his house. There were laws at the time in place to protect accused people or defendants, but we did not have any laws that would protect the victims. Now, because of these laws, the jury didn't know that Davidson had a slew of criminal proceedings before him. They didn't know about any of the prior carjackings and robberies that he did. So this act prevents families like Shannon's from having to deal with the pain of listening to an attorney, a defense attorney, or a defendant themselves defaming their loved one's memory. And as heavy as that was, that is the case of Shannon Christian and Christopher Newsom. I want to thank you guys so much for listening into today's episode. If there's anything that you would like to add on or anything that I got wrong or missed, please feel free to comment on it. You can reach out on YouTube, reach out via email at manicmanorpodcast@gmail.com. You can also go online to Facebook and Instagram at Manic Manor Podcast. And if you feel so inclined, like I said, we do have a Patreon set up, although it's definitely not necessary for anybody. So that does it for today. I hope you guys will have a wonderful week, and as always, I will see you in our next episode.